This morning, on the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, Nelson History Theater is presenting a documentary commemoration of Colonel Arnold Kemble, a brave soldier and loving husband and father. This documentary is based on a commemorative website at kootenayhistory.com. It was created by Richard Roberry and Avia Moore, with funding assistance from the Columbia Kootenay Cultural Alliance and BC Gaming. We also thank Touchstone's Nelson Museum of Art and History for its archival support, and the Royal Canadian Legion, Nelson Branch 51.
Nelson History Theatre presents A Brave Soldier, The Life and Death of Colonel Arnold Kemble. The century between the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 and the First World War has been called the Pax Britannica, because during that time England and its empire used military and economic might to maintain a relatively peaceful balance of power among the other great European nations. This is not to say, however, that England's armed forces remained inactive. Indeed, 58 of the 64 years of Queen Victoria's reign found them engaged in some form of military action. These were, with the exception of the Crimean War, colonial conflicts. Either designated as outright wars, Afghanistan, Zulu, Boer, etc., or simply as expeditions, they took place in Africa, India, China, and British North America. They were undertaken to secure borders, expand territory, protect trade, or suppress rebellions. The various armies which Great Britain used to maintain and expand its empire were manned by a relatively few English, Irish, and Scottish regiments, augmented by large numbers of native troops. They were officered by white, professional British soldiers, many of whom came from families with a tradition of military service, which went back many generations. The more successful of these were able to rise from the middle class until they had achieved a social position among the lower ranks of the aristocracy. Among families which had established themselves as faithful servants of the crown in India were the Kembles. When the various European trading companies came on the scene in the 18th century, India was a collection of Muslim and Hindu states, often at war among themselves, and thus easily played off against each other. Over the years, they gained ever-increasing territorial control, until the most successful, the British East India Company, became masters of the entire subcontinent. They administered these native states, known as residencies, on behalf of the various puppet rulers, and controlled them through the deployment of large private armies, working in concert with the regular British army. By the middle of the 19th century, India was the empire's richest colony, and the Kembles were among its more prominent military figures. Vero Clark Kemble, born in 1780, was a medical officer with the East India Company and rose to become Surgeon General of the Indian Medical Department. His son, Arnold Burroughs Kemble, served as an officer in the British Army and later became a successful diplomat, ending his career with a knighthood and the rank of general. His brother, John Shaw Kemble, also brought honor and social advancement to the family, achieving the rank of Major General. He had two sons, George Vero Kemble and Arnold Henry Grant Kemble. George also became a Major General, served with distinction in India, Africa, and Mesopotamia during World War I, and was awarded the Distinguished Service Order, made Knight Commander of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, and Companion of the Order of the Bath. His brother Arnold is the subject of this documentary.
I was born in 1861 in Belgaum, India, about 300 miles south of Bombay. My father's regiment was stationed there to keep an eye on the Portuguese at Goa. It was a grand life for a boy growing up, riding, hunting, that sort of thing.
At least until George and I were shipped off to England to be civilized. Bit of a shock. Rotten climate. Dreary schoolmasters. But we survived. There was never any question about us going into the army, of course. I certainly couldn't have imagined anything else. It was a Kemble tradition, for one thing, and the quickest way back to India. George, who was my elder by 3 years, went to the Royal Military College, Woolwich, and so into the Royal Artillery. It was the Royal Military College, Sandhurst, for me. George's career was a model of steady advancement, beginning with the Second Afghan War in 1878. After that, he participated in several campaigns in the Northwest Frontier before receiving command of the West African Frontier Force in Nigeria in 1901 and the Kano-Sokoto Expedition in 03. For the next 11 years, he served in the War Office in London, and during the present war, he commanded Indian troops in various campaigns in the Middle East against the Ottoman Empire. He was knighted in 1917 and retired in 1919. My career, while not quite as brilliant as George's, ran along similar lines. In 1880, I joined the 1st Battalion of the Royal Scots, the oldest infantry regiment in the British Army, by the by, and served for 2 years in Malta. When it was shipped off to the West Indies, I transferred out, first to the Baloch Regiment of the Bombay Residency Army, and then to the 5th Gurkha Rifles of the British Indian Army. Now, the Gurkhas, you have to understand, were damn fine warriors, even better than the Sikhs, in my estimation, though I say it who shouldn't. Their tribesmen from Nepal, who fought against us early on with such success that after we made peace, we brought them over to our side. There's a saying I'm rather fond of. If a man says he's not afraid of dying, he's either a liar or a Gurkha.
From 1888 to 1898, Kemble fought in several campaigns along the Northwest frontier. As a relatively junior officer, he served with the Black Mountain and Hazara expeditions from 1888 to 91. These were punitive campaigns which took place in what is now Pakistan in retaliation for raids by Pathan tribesmen into British-held territory. In 1893, while on leave in England, then Captain Kemble went on a winter holiday to Norway and was snowed in at a ski lodge. Also trapped with him was an 18-year-old Norwegian girl, Alvilda Vivi Sundt, and her mother.
I thought she was absolutely delightful. A wonderful skier, and lots of fun in the evening, playing games in front of the fire. By the end of our 10-day confinement, we'd become engaged. Her father had died a few years before, and her mother was none too keen to lose her daughter quite yet. She was quite young, too, of course, and the thinking was if we could put up with the 2-year separation until my next leave, we had a better chance of making a go of it. I grumbled a bit, of course, but saw the wisdom of it, too. No choice, really. Anyhow, 2 years later, we were married at the church at St. Mary's in Stansted, Kent, the home parish of the Kendall family.
After a brief honeymoon, the Kembles traveled to India, where Arnold introduced his young wife to the life of a Mem Sahib on the frontier. They took up residence in Abbottabad, which was the British military headquarters for the Peshawar region and home to the Gurkha regiments. There, Vivi took charge of an exotic and luxurious household run by an army of native servants and gave birth to 2 daughters, Dorothy Mary in 1896 and Gerda Cecilia 3 years later. In 1897, the Northwest frontier was again ablaze when the Afridi tribesmen, who had been paid by the British to guard the nearby Khyber Pass, suddenly rebelled and occupied all the forts along the India-Afghanistan border. The subsequent Tira expedition was one of the most difficult colonial campaigns experienced by the British Indian Army. Captain Kemble was mentioned in dispatches for his role in the fighting and was soon promoted to Major. In 1905, he was again promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and given a command of a battalion of the 5th Gurkhas. 2 years later, he was appointed Colonel of the entire regiment. Before taking up this final command, the Kembles returned to England and installed their daughters, now 11 and 8 years old, at Belstead House School in Suffolk. The school had been established for military families serving in India, and the girls remained there for the next 3 years. In 1912, after his retirement, he was made a Companion of the Order of the Bath in recognition of his 30 years' service in India.
It was a tremendous honour to be made Colonel of the 5th Gurkhas, and Vivi and I thoroughly enjoyed our 3 years in command of the regiment. But of course we missed the girls, and the prospect of year after year of army routine began to lose its lustre. On the other hand, the thought of retiring to endless afternoon teas and lawn bowling tournaments in England felt tedious in the extreme. Not to mention the descent from Oriental luxury in one of the world's most benign climates to a modest resident in dreary, rain-sodden Kent, where a respectable social position would have to be maintained on a colonel's meager pension. Still, we were both relatively young. I was a perfectly fit 49, and Vivi a mere 35, so we began casting about for a new adventure.
Inspired by the novels of Rudyard Kipling, Rider Haggard, and John Buchan, as well as dreams of adventure and prosperity, thousands of English men and women were flocking to South Africa, Kenya, Australia, Canada, and other outposts of the Empire. The poor to work in mines and farms. Their wealthier cousins, remittance men, and retired military officers like Kimball, to establish ranches and plantations. In 1910, one of the more exotic locales was the Kootenai district of British Columbia, whose cherries, apples, and berries were winning prizes across Canada and even at agricultural exhibitions in London. Quite probably, it was not a novel, but a non-fiction work that inspired the Kembles. Fruit Ranching in British Columbia by John Thomas Bilby was a how-to book, a travel adventure, and a sales catalogue all in one. Published in 1909 in North America, England, Australia, and India, the Kembles may well have come across it while conducting their post-retirement research. Bilby settled in Nelson in 1907 and purchased a prosperous farm with almost 600 fruit trees already planted and producing, and so painted a very rosy picture of the splendors and profitability of Kootenai agriculture.
One of the most wonderful sights in a British Columbia orchard, and more especially a Kootenai orchard, is the cherry trees when laden with their snow-white blossoms. Every branch, from its divergence from a large limb or the main trunk, right away to the outermost twig, is thickly feathered with clusters of blossoms, and tufts of bloom cling even to the main trunk and large limbs. This is true of every variety of cherry alike, sour as well as sweet. The crops are, as a rule, enormously heavy, so much so that the trees, and this applies to pears, apples, and plums, as well as to cherries, have to be well supported with props to prevent them from breaking down under the loads they carry. Tiny hummingbirds with bright vermilion throats hover on tireless wings above the blossoms of apple, pear, plum, and cherry during May, and later sip honey from the nectar cups of gladioli, sweet peas, and other fragrant flowers. The principal game bird, though we did not find its numbers at all inconvenient, is called the grouse. This is by no means a shy or timid bird. It clings to cover until you almost tread on it, and even when it does flush, it will settle again a very few feet away. On one occasion I put up the same bird 3 times within the space of 25 yards and less than 2 minutes of time. Slocan Junction, which is within a mile and a half of Bonnington Falls, boasts one of the most famous fishing pools in the interior of British Columbia. The mainstay of the fruit grower in the Kootenai is of necessity the apple. The later varieties, and especially the winter varieties, can be kept for periods varying from 4 to some 30 weeks, affording ample opportunity to seize the most favorable moment for putting the fruit on the market. British Columbia apples travel to England, a journey of over 5,000 miles, and even to Australia. The Spitzenbergs and Yellow Newton Pippins of the American states of Oregon and Washington find their best markets in New York, London, Glasgow, and Liverpool.
Even at this early date, the best available land close to Nelson had already been developed, and what remained was quickly snapped up. After that, the pickings were much slimmer. As the land rose steeply up the sides of the valley, it became rockier and drier. During the previous two decades, prospectors had burned off the trees, scorching the thin soil and causing much of it to erode into the lake below. Before fruit trees could be planted, the charred stumps had to be removed, an irrigation system put in place, and the soil painstakingly replenished. Many an enthusiastic purchaser with bilby-colored dreams had a rude awakening, including the Kimballs. Writing a memoir years later, Gerda Jukes, née Kimball, described her parents' first encounter with Kootenay real estate.
The Kootenay district of British Columbia, then highly touted as a suitable area for those wishing to break new ground, seemed highly suited to father's tastes. He purchased sight unseen from a realty firm in Nelson, B.C., some wilderness property in Crawford Bay described as being adopted to orchard development. Early in 1910, father and mother arrived in Nelson, outfitted themselves with tenting equipment, hired a Chinaman to assist in clearing the property, and set out on the steamer for Crawford Bay. Only by courtesy could father's property be considered in Crawford Bay, since it was located at least 2 miles from the lakeshore on a bench singularly devoid of water. The Chinaman took one look at the trees, rocks, and underbrush, which covered the acreage, and announced tersely, "I quit, I go," whereupon he darted. Father and mother were made of sterner stuff, however. They pitched their tent and had their first go at shifting for themselves. As my father became familiar with the area, he realized that the lack of water doomed his land as an orchard prospect. He and mother booked passage for England, but before departing, father contacted a land developer in Caslow and advised him that my uncle Jack, due for leave from the army in India, would be coming out within the year to the Kootenay in search of suitable orchard land for retirement purposes, and subsequently settled on 2 lakeshore properties located at the far end of Shuddy Bench, about 5 miles north of Caslow, and watered by 2 creeks.
Meanwhile, back in England, Vivi and I were preparing ourselves for our new lives. I with training in the basics of agriculture and irrigation engineering, and Vivi by taking cooking lessons. We then hired a Norwegian couple who was to join us the next year, and set out for Canada a second time.
No amount of schooling could have equipped us to cope with the type of life which faced us the moment our feet left the footplank of the Kokanee and led us up the small clearing. We were immediately thrust into a most primitive lifestyle, sleeping on rough bunks, dipping water from the nearby creek, and cooking on a converted kerosene tin. Mother's lessons in haute cuisine did not impair her adaptability unduly, and she began to cope with admirable celerity, allowing herself the luxury of an occasional good weep at the end of a particularly back-breaking day. Dorothy and I, innate tomboys, both gifted with good health and spirits, took immediately to life in the backwoods. My father, a born craftsman and woodsman, settled right down to the task of clearing land, using a horse and chain pulleys as well as powder when things got particularly tough. Let it not be thought that we abandoned amenities entirely, however. Father always donned a dark suit, and mother a suitable afternoon dress, for dinner, while Dorothy and I appeared at the dinner table garbed in tussar smocks. We made tremendous strides in 1911. By December, with the help of Hogan and Adriana, we were looking after pigs and chickens, some land had been cleared, and the exterior of a spacious house had been completed. As the winter days shortened, my mother decided that we should have some proper Scandinavian festivities at Christmas. Father was accordingly dispatched to Caslow in our small, one-cylinder, open-air launch, christened Gurkha, with invitation to friends in Caslow and Queens Bay to come up to our ranch the day before Christmas. 3 days before Christmas, the Kokanee made an unscheduled call at our beach. And to our absolute amazement, Mother's older married sister, Mrs. Jacqueline, walked down the footplank. As one of a lifelong series of futile measures to cure her husband of alcoholism, our Tante Agnes had set out from Norway with him to try homesteading on the Canadian prairie. Several months wrestling with nature in the wilds of Alberta, having effected no improvement in Uncle's drinking habits, Tante Agnes had decided that she owed herself a long vacation, so she had packed her bags and caught the train west. Diminutive and zestful, Tante fell in enthusiastically with our plans. I can see her now, ensconced in a snowbank in order to combine the mixings for the festive mayonnaise at a proper temperature. Our guests arrived by launch the morning before Christmas Eve, but the day was to bring even more excitement. Shortly after noon, the steamer Kokanee made another unscheduled call at our beach, ran out the gangplank, and as we watched, stunned with surprise, our household furniture and furnishings, neatly stowed in packing cases, were trundled down onto the snow-covered sand. A wild scramble then ensued as guests and hosts alike pitched in to haul the cases to our half-finished house. Carpets were laid, chairs and beds made up for our guests. Our Christmas Eve celebration was truly one of the high points of my life.
April 10th, 1912. We are very busy now, clearing land and building. Hogan and I have just finished quite a smart stable and shed. It really is as good as a carpenter could have done, but I will confess it took us rather longer, as neither of us has ever put up a building before, and a certain amount of time was spent in settling how difficulties were to be met. We've had only one snowstorm, I think, since the early part of February, so we've been at work outside for the last 2 months, burning up the large piles of brush about the place. I've got one half the land very nearly completely burnt, which is long and very dirty work. The brush is first cut, slashed, and the trees felled. This has to dry out, and then with luck one gets a running fire. That is, the whole thing is set fire to. Of course, it's very dirty work, as the charcoal dust works through the skin, and one is as black under one's clothes as one's hands and face are. However, it's good clean work, and there's lots of water. I like the work immensely, particularly the axe work, but I confess I'm a bit sick of the cross-cut saw on a big gummy log over 2 feet thick. It makes one puff and blow. I've had a Chinaman for a fortnight, blowing stumps and some more land ready for him. On the 1st May, the teamster comes with his horses to pull out the remains of the stumps and to plough. The land will then be sown to vetch, which will be ploughed in next spring, just before planting. Cherries are a bit of a gamble. Everything will depend on what labor one can get after 4 years to do the picking. They sell now for 20 or 40 cents a pound, and there seems to be a great demand for them. A 3-year-old tree bears 40 pounds of fruit, $8 worth, so with 100 trees to the acre, there's something to be got out of it pretty soon. Anyway, whether it turns out the big thing I hope or not, I don't see how I can lose over it, and it's very interesting having something to try and work up to. We've been very fortunate in our Norwegian couple. Vivi likes the woman, and I'm entirely satisfied with the man who works like a horse. He never talks at his work, unless spoke to, but always looks pleased, and really likes working, so he's very easy to get on with. He's learning English quite fast, though how he does it beats me, as we talk very little. But I imagine he studies the dictionary in the evening, as he comes out with words he's not heard from any of us. The children seem to be quite happy and interested in the chickens. These have paid us just $2 a bird for the 10 months we have had them, not counting what it's cost to buy them. But that was roughly half a dollar a head. I'm now handing the fowls over to the children, making them up to 100 stock hens, as I make out that 25 will supply the needs of the house, and after doing that the children can take the profit for pocket money, which ought to be a good thing if they manage decently. So far, all is going as well as possible with us, and better than I expected. I don't think any of us regret coming out. The others say they don't, and I'm quite sure I would not change back to India for anything they like to offer me. If everything turns out quite well, as I hope for in 6 years' time, the ranch ought to be bringing in £2,000 a year profit. But I don't really suppose it will. Only it might. The children have taken to shooting with a small rifle, and are now quite good shots.
Father's preparatory work in England began to stand him in good stead, for the flume works which he constructed proved to be a highly effective irrigation system. The summer brought us Uncle Jack, out on short leave from India. A hitherto confirmed bachelor, he fell deeply in love with a beautiful young girl whose parents ranched on the west arm of Kootenay Lake. Neither this love affair, nor his love affair with his Kootenay Lake property, was ever brought to fruition, however, for Uncle Jack was fated to die of an illness in India before he was due for retirement. For the first couple of years, we concentrated on growing berry crops. On some occasions, we would cram our little put-put launch full of crated berries and meander down the lake shore to the express office in Caslow. Our faithful launch, Gurkha, also served us for picnics and for the occasional shopping expedition into Caslow. Dorothy and I rarely saw children our own age, but we did on occasion have some interesting outings. I recall an excursion which we made up to the Hauser on Duncan Lake, where Harry Hinks and his brothers and a group of other retired army types had established a fruit ranching settlement on the principles enunciated in Shakespeare's Love's Labour's Lost. Any Hauser resident contemplating matrimony was honor-bound to sell his property and leave the community. It was an idyllic existence these men led on the shores of Duncan Lake, and their community was but one of many in the district which harbored a number of happy-go-lucky Englishmen reveling in the life on the frontier. World War I largely put an end to this sort of carefree life, as it ended also the structured sort of life in Britain from which they had escaped. The months sped by on our lakeshore hideaway. Winters were given over to studies with Father, and to strenuous winter sports such as skiing and tobogganing. In the summer months, the hours which could be snatched from physical toil were devoted to swimming, boating, and fly fishing in our mountain streams. Soon it was the summer of 1914, one of those radiant summers of seemingly endless sunshine, punctuated by the occasional exciting thunderstorm. Father completed the planting of our orchard, and we were kept very busy crating boxes of strawberries to Caslow in our faithful launch. The declaration of war in August 1914 struck the Kootenay district like a tornado, uprooting hordes of young Englishmen and Canadians, new arrivals and old, from their lakeshore properties.
The war came like a thunderbolt out of what was for us a clear blue sky. We were up to our necks in our berry crops and cherry trees with nearly a glance at the newspapers. Not that there was much in them in any case. Vivi and I sat down and talked it through, of course, and we decided to wait and see. There seemed to be a strong opinion in some quarters that it was a bit of a storm in a teacup, and everyone would stand down after the requisite amount of bloodletting on both sides. After all, these were civilized nations, and surely they knew what a modern war would let them in for. On the other hand, I was a trained soldier, and there was no question that I would put up my hand if needs be. I sent off a note to my old Gurkha regiment, asking if I was wanted, but they declined with thanks. Frankly, I was the thankful one. However, by the spring of 1915, it was clear that cooler heads had not prevailed, and the Germans needed to be put down once and for all. I'd been helping organize the 54th Kootenay Battalion, with headquarters at Nelson, and was appointed second in command. By the middle of June 1915, a full quota of men had been recruited, and we were on our way to training camp in Vernon.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Mother Dorothy and I were left to maintain the fruit ranch, with whatever casual help might be available, our Norwegian couple having departed some time before. Carry on we did, determined to develop an orchard that Father would be proud to return home to. I must pay tribute to the tremendous help which we received at this time from the neighboring Dukhobor women. In all the years during which Mother was left to manage the ranch on her own, we found these Dukhobor women to be honest, faithful, and diligent employees. At the end of the summer, Lieutenant Colonel Davies was posted to raise a pioneer battalion in eastern Canada, and Father was given command of the 54th, with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. We all participated in some of the formal round of leave-taking, which preceded their departure for England in November 1915. Our final parting with Father occurred at a tumultuous send-off at Revelstoke, one which I am sure is still recalled poignantly by many. The festivities over, we went back to the solitude of our lakeshore home to endure one of the heaviest winters of snowfall the district had ever known. We heard frequently from Father, who was stationed with his battalion at Bramshot Camp, located near the intersection of the county borders of Hampshire, Surrey, and Sussex.
At Bramshot Camp, the regiment underwent more intensive training, specifically geared towards the new reality of trench warfare. Colonel Kemble is credited with molding his raw recruits into a well-prepared and cohesive fighting force. He recruited his staff from officers whom he had worked with previously in India. This caused some criticism, but was undoubtedly helpful in making it possible to withstand the pressure from high command to break up the 54th in order to replace losses suffered by other battalions. Finally, they were assigned to the 4th Canadian Division, led by Major General David Watson, as part of the 11th Brigade under the command of Brigadier General Victor Odlum. It is worth noting that these two commanders had considerably less active service experience than Kemble, which suggests that Canadian military and political leaders were determined to reserve the upper ranks for native-born officers. On the 13th of August 1916, the 54th crossed the Channel to France. They were assigned to the Ypres salient site of the first German gas attacks earlier in the war, where the courageous and costly resistance of Canadian soldiers held the line and established their reputation as first-class troops. After a month of hands-on acclimatization in this now relatively quiet sector, they were sent back behind the lines in order to prepare to join the massive assault against the German defenses along the River Somme. The Battle of the Somme, July 1st to November 18th, 1916, was one of the bloodiest battles of World War I, in which the British and French High Command launched a series of frontal attacks across barbed wire-strewn open ground against entrenched German infantry armed with gas, artillery, and machine guns. There were 1.2 million dead and wounded on both sides. As part of the British Expeditionary Force, the Canadian Corps had been drawn in division by division since the end of August. In early November, it was the turn of the 4th Division. CanadianSoldiers.com is an excellent website, which gives an overview of various aspects of Canadian military history from 1900 to the present. The following is its description of the final attack of the Battle of the Somme, carried out by elements of the Canadian Corps, which was spearheaded by the 54th Battalion.
The night of 17-18 November brought the winter's first snowfall, and the operations began just after 6 a.m. on 18th November in a driving sleet that changed to driving rain as the morning progressed. The 4th Division attacked on a frontage of 2,200 yards. The infantry was forced to plod through freezing mud, the snow masking objectives and causing units to lose direction. Artillery observers couldn't spot targets and could only fire their prearranged programs. The Canadian task was to seize Desire's support trench and establish a new line 100 to 150 yards beyond, exploiting farther if possible. At 0 hour, while maintaining a concentrated standing barrage on the enemy trenches, the guns put down a creeping barrage behind which the infantry companies advanced in four waves at intervals of 50 yards or less. Fine coordination between artillery and infantry brought excellent results. In less than an hour, the 54th Battalion had sent back its first group of prisoners. By 8 o'clock, both brigades had gained their initial objectives and were hastily digging in beyond desired support. A German counterattack against the 54th ended suddenly as the enemies threw down their weapons and surrendered. A second threat was broken up by artillery fire. On the left, the 38th and 87th Battalions, having overrun both Desire and Desire Support, pushed strong patrols down the slope to Grandcourt Trench, establishing machine gun posts there and taking more prisoners. The day's total harvest was 17 officers and 608 other ranks, and the gains of the day had been considerable. A half-mile advance on a 2,000-yard front for the loss of 1,250 casualties, while inflicting heavy losses in killed, wounded, and prisoners. In any event, heavy rain on the 19th of November prevented any further attacks regardless of the ability of the British Corps to continue, and the 4th Canadian Division had at last fought its final battle on the Somme. As a result of this success, Colonel Kemble was awarded the Distinguished Service Order, which was given to officers in actual combat who had distinguished themselves while under fire. It was also generally considered to reflect honor on the soldiers under his command. The weather, which had been the worst in many years, then prevented further operations, and the battalion, after a brief spell behind the lines, was transferred further north as part of the Canadian Corps' preparations for the attack on Vimy Ridge. 1917 was to be the British Army's turn to try to apply its tactical lessons against the German line in a series of attacks which were to continue throughout 1917. The first of these was given to the Canadian Corps and was to be an assault on Vimy Ridge. Thorough preparation was to be the key, and to this end, elaborate communication trenches and tunnels were created in order to deliver a mass attack of troops supported by a barrage of artillery. In order to understand what they were facing, the upper command ordered a series of raids across no man's land. One such raid was to be conducted by four battalions of the 4th Division, including Kemble's 54th. A special feature of this attack was the use of phosgene gas, a deadly nerve agent with the ironic smell of new-mown hay. In his book, No Place to Run, The Canadian Corps and Gas Warfare in the First World War, Tim Cook describes this raid in detail as an example of futility and incompetence.
The oversized raid was to consist of 1,700 officers and men from the 54th, 72nd, 73rd, and 75th Battalions, preceded by a bombardment and a release of canister gas to achieve surprise and overcome the German defenders. The fact that the assault against Hill 145 would be moving uphill does not appear to have worried General David Watson or his General Staff Officer Edmund Ironside. The bristling fortified defenses and interlocking machine gun nests that the Germans had reinforced for 2 years were deemed a powerful position, but it was assumed that the poison gas would paralyze the defenders so the infantry could close and do battle. Despite the largely unsuccessful use of the gas clouds in this way to date, the divisional gas officer, Lieutenant Henry Beaumont, gave little if any warning that the gas, which followed the contours of the ground and sank into crevices and shell holes because of its weight in comparison to air, would require a stiff breeze to move it up the hill. Gas remained a misunderstood weapon, and because of its technical and scientific nature, it was shunted to the periphery to be used by specialists who were seen more as chemists than soldiers. Bent on a raiding mentality, the 4th Division's staff officers overlooked the obvious disadvantages of their plan, perhaps because their gas specialist gave no reason for concern. More likely, they assumed that it would work because they needed it to. The raid's planners proceeded to place their faith and their men's lives behind a wave of gas. There was little understanding of chemical warfare by senior commanders. When gas was implemented, senior officers always hoped that it would emulate the first gas cloud release of the war, when two whole divisions were routed. Although poison gas was still a weapon that inspired terror, better gas discipline and respirators ensured that no such rout would occur again. Yet, given their formidable position on the hill and its defenses, gas was needed because other, more conventional weapons could not guarantee success. Gas was not the armament of choice, but of desperation. Ill-placed hope created illusion that outweighed all logical assumptions. It fell to the pack mules of the army, the infantry, to once again lug up thousands of 100-pound metal cylinders. Although everything was organized by the night of the 25th, 26th of February, the wind remained uncooperative, and they were forced to delay the release.
My orders required me to pass on to my men that 15 tons of gas were to be sent over to strike terror into the black heart of the enemy. The first wave was to be of deadly poisonous gas that would kill every living thing in his path, while the second would corrode all metal substances and destroy guns of every description. This was the official line from both commanders and gas officers, and was pure folly. The commander of the 75th, Sam Beckett, and I knew better, and submitted to General Odlum that because of the unpredictable wind, the raid should be postponed and more artillery brought to bear on the German lines. It was also clear to us that the enemy had been alerted to the use of gas in the attack by the clanking of the gas cylinders as they were being carried up to our position.
Aware that two of his experienced and decorated battalion commanders were unhappy with the plan, Odlum questioned his orders by writing to and visiting Lieutenant Colonel Edmund Ironside. Despite getting into a heated argument with Ironside, bordering on insubordination, as one officer reported, Odlum received no definite answer to his central concern about how, if the gas failed, his men were to get across no man's land before the enemy barrage opened up. A future chief of the Imperial General Staff of the British Army, the massive Ironside, who stood 6 feet 4 inches and weighed 220 pounds, had a firm hand on controlling the division, and, as some junior officers noted, had undue influence over Divisional Commander David Watson. Ironside, possibly on orders from Watson, refused to entertain ideas about postponement. Too much planning and hope were riding on the raid. Hoping for the best, the attack groups remained at the ready. Thus, two experienced battalion commanders, who were close to the front and saw the formidable defenses their men were up against, were ignored by the staff officers, who relied on a dubious weapon to overcome defenders who had spent 2 years fortifying their position. Such actions did not bode well. The inconsistent weather, a superior German position, and the normal difficulties associated with a large-scale assault, especially one that involved hundreds of men carrying clanging metal objects to the front, meant that the surprise of the attack, the fundamental aspect for the gas component to succeed, was lost. Nerves began to fray as the interconnected infantry, artillery, gas specialists, and commanders waited hour after hour for the start signal. During the wait, at least one German artillery barrage searching Canadian lines punctured some of the canisters. A sentry noticed the gas and awoke his platoon, but, not wanting to alert the Germans, they could not raise a gas alarm. Word was quietly passed along the trenches, but it failed to reach a small group of infantrymen in the path of a wayward cloud. All were poisoned, and one man suffocated to death. The Canadians were learning the hard way that employing infantry and gas was a dangerous proposition. Still, the attack remained unchanged. The raiders were to follow behind the second of two gas clouds into the German trenches. It was planned that the second release would catch many of the Germans unprepared, exhausted, and lethargic from the ordeal of the first gas cloud. The hours of waiting turned into days. A full 3 days passed before the 4th Division's headquarters received the code word CAT from the British gas specialists to indicate proper weather conditions.
By this time, both Kemble and Colonel Beckett were convinced that the raid would be a colossal disaster, and that they were honor-bound to personally lead their men over the top. They felt that their previous experience gave them the best chance of finding a way through the enemy's barbed wire. On the night of February 28th, alone in his dugout, Colonel Kemble wrote a farewell letter to his wife.
My own darling, we've moved forward to attack tomorrow. At dawn, following gas clouds. It's a dirty job, and all one can say is that the beastly Germans started using it. I'm not in favor of using it at all, but if it is done at all, it ought to be on the grand scale, so as to do real harm to the enemy, but we're just playing with it, and only putting it over on a front of little more than a mile. Everything depends on the wind being just right when done as we're doing it, and the odds are we won't do any real damage. I'm going over with the attack, as there is a difficult job on our right. And although I'm not supposed to go, I think both men and officers would expect me to do so after the rot that was put in the Gazette about me. One thing is, the gas cloud will probably miss the right, so we will first have a straight fight for it. And if the officers survive the advance, we will have the pleasure of trying to knock the stuffing out of Fritz. Of course, by the time you get this, you will know how I have fared. But if I should get knocked out, remember that it's no more than is to be expected at this game, and that one has to do one's job to the best of one's ability without too much regard for one's skin. I've never ceased to love you, and am always thinking of you all. Nothing would please me better than for the war to end tomorrow and to get back to Canada in quick time. Anyhow, I don't worry about you all financially, as you're all entitled to a good pension from Canada, in addition to the Indian and King's ones, about which you will find pamphlets in my suitcase or somewhere. Mother's estate has not been settled up yet, but there is about £300 in addition to the trust money. Eva's promised to leave half her money to the girls, so eventually you'll all be on Easy Street. If you're wise, you won't be in a hurry to get rid of the ranch, and don't let yourself be persuaded to get out of it until the trees are at least 4 or 5 years older. Don't try to farm, but have the trees looked after, with the idea of having something to sell that is worth buying, and you then ought to get a good price for the place if you feel like quitting. If you sell, do it through a lawyer, and you won't get into difficulties. Goodbye, dearest. Heaps and heaps of love and kisses.
Finally, at 3 a.m. on March 1st, the Special Company's gas sergeants, wearing red, white, and green brassards for identification, released 1,038 cylinders of chlorine and phosgene gas into a stiff breeze of 9 miles per hour, which in some areas carried it quickly over to the German lines. Unfortunately for the Canadians, the German defenders had only recently been issued orders to combat a gas attack.
As soon as the alarm is given, shoot up red and green flares. Our artillery will fire into the gas cloud and on the hostile trenches.
True to orders, the German counter-barrage fell on the Canadian lines and immediately punctured 3 canisters, gassing several Canadians and gas specialists and further lowering the infantry's impression of their chemical agents. The raiders were to go into no man's land at 5:40, 40 minutes after a second discharge of gas. But minutes before the second gas cloud was to be released, the wind changed, and a second wave of gas could not be liberated. In the 12th Brigade sector, however, the message to hold off was not received, and when the gas was released, it slowly moved up the ridge, only to stop and lazily float back toward the Canadian lines, eventually drifting through the waiting soldiers. Because the gas was so dense in the crowded trenches, the raiding parties, mostly from the 73rd Battalion, were forced to leave their safety, suffering additional casualties from conventional weapons as they proceeded overland until they found their assembly points. Already committed to battle and spurred on by their earlier dominance, they continued with the plan and hoped that the Germans had been sufficiently overcome by the first wave of gas. They were not.
On the day of the assault, the situation was this. The Germans had been alerted to the use of gas by the clanking of the cylinders being carried up to the line. The men had been in the forward trenches for 3 days, exposed to leaking gas and shell fire. Artillery had made a poor job of breaking up the enemy wire, and the markers placed in no man's land on the original day of attack were being used by the Germans for directing their machine gun fire. My request for postponement and the use of more artillery had been refused, and I was ordered to remain behind, but of course that was impossible. Sam Beckett felt the same. At 0 hour, we went over the bags in a headlong assault into a massed enemy fire. The gas had been expected to paralyze the enemy, and white flags had therefore been set up overnight to mark the gaps in the wire.
They drew the men into natural killing zones as German machine gunners fired towards those hard-to-miss targets. In order not to alert the enemy, there had been only a very poor attempt at clearing the wire with explosives. I was at the head of a group of men trying to push our way through a gap when I was hit by a spray of bullets and killed.
The futile assault degenerated into a mad scramble, but throughout it the Canadians displayed their reputation for dogged tenacity that they had won on earlier battlefields. Despite their relentless push forward, it was a grim time as friends and companions who had survived the horror of the Somme were cut down in swathes. Added to the confusion of losing most senior commanding officers, vapors of the first and second wave of gas clung to shell holes in no man's land, so that the attackers had to advance through their own lethal agent. In addition, the Germans fired gas shells into the assembly trenches of the attacking Canadians. Although this caused few casualties, it forced the raiders to don their respirators, which left them almost blind as they ran through the lingering gas, desperately searching for gaps in the wire as bullets and shells rained down. Despite this frontal attack, the Canadians cleared a 500-yard section of the German trenches in hand-to-hand fighting. The inability to reinforce the raiders and the general breakdown of the assault meant the retreating Canadians, jumbled together from the four battalions, fought a running battle with the Germans. Cut off from their own lines by counterattacks, the Canadian infantry risked having all survivors captured. A successful rearguard action by several officers allowed dozens of men to escape, but as one trench warrior observed, we had very heavy casualties, especially among the officers. As the futility of the attack became apparent, frontline officers, from battalion commanders to the lowest lieutenant, sacrificed themselves for their men. Those soldiers wounded in no man's land crawled to shell holes for safety, and in the process often fell victim to their own gas, which pooled in the mucky depressions. Stuck in a crater while the Germans sniped at anything that moved, Private Stanley Baker remembered watching the men in his large hole slowly being killed as exposed heads and backs were blasted by sharpshooters. Employing one of the corpses for cover, he used his helmet to dig a shallow trench through the muck to reach another hole in the rear. The lingering gases made him cry and vomit, but he finally wormed his way back to the Canadian line later that night. As soldiers dragged themselves into the trenches, their chlorine-tarnished brass buttons were just as noticeable as their ashen faces and bluish lips. The chaos of battle, with smoke and fire obscuring vision, and gas masks clouding up and reducing the intake of breath, had forced many of the soldiers to remove their respirators for periods of time in a desperate need to locate gaps in the wire. Masks could not be worn all the time. Any heavy exertion, like running up the ridge while under fire, provoked near strangulation effects, as not enough oxygen entered through the filters. The nature of enemy fire forced all to take cover. Many who did not quickly move from their corrupted shell holes never left their informal graves. When the roll was called the next day, the full extent of the disaster was known. The four attacking battalions suffered 687 casualties. Those men who were not too numb with exhaustion or suffering from the lingering effects of gas began to question the whole raid. The war diary of the 54th critically remarked that the first discharge of gas apparently had no effect on the enemy, but more important, the question arises as to why anyone would have thought any differently.
In order for the Canadians to gather up their wounded and dead, a truce was arranged. The Germans, recognizing Kimball's heroism, brought down his flag-draped body with an honor guard. He was buried wrapped in a simple gray blanket, along with those of his officers and men who had suffered the same fate, at the nearby Villers Station Cemetery. His grave was marked by a standard-issue wooden cross, which was later replaced by a more permanent tombstone.
The Nelson Daily News, April 26, 1921. In the presence of a huge gathering of people from Nelson, Trail, Rosland, Slocan, and other points, and before about 40 members of the 54th Battalion standing at attention, Lieutenant Governor R. Randolph Bruce, after making a brief address, untied the ribbons which held a large Union Jack flag over the memorial tablet in memory of the late Colonel A. H. G. Kemble, commander of the 54th Overseas Battalion, who was killed in action at Vimy Ridge. The unveiling was part of the program of the opening of the Nelson-Caslow Scenic Highway. The idea of the memorial tablet was originated among a number of the 54th Battalion men at Seaforth, England, in 1918, when a subscription list was opened and funds subscribed. Major Gilbert Anderson of the 54th Battalion Nelson said that they were honoring the memory of one of the most distinguished Caslow citizens. Fate on several occasions threatened the 54th Kootenai Battalion with extinction, he declared, and it was only for the personal influence exerted by Colonel Kemble that calamity was averted and they proceeded to France as a unit of the 11th Brigade. He stated that this spirit shown for the welfare of the officers and the men of his command naturally caused him to be held in the highest esteem. Major Anderson said that all ranks regarded the late colonel as a friend at all times and a counselor of experience when in need of advice. He declared that the colonel knew how to fight and had laid down his life on the battlefield in unselfish devotion to his duty, king, and country. As the flag was unfurled, three members of the Canadian Legion Bugle Band, buglers Dave Wade, Spurgeon Langle, and Fred Hartwig, and drummers Sid J. MacDonald and Claude Miller, sounded the last post in wartime style. A feature of this role was that Spurgeon Langle was among the buglers who sounded the last post at the funeral of the late Colonel Kemble near Vimy Ridge in March 1917.
A Brave Soldier was created by Richard Roberry and recorded and edited by Brian Dion. The voices were those of Brian Dion, Richard Roberry, Jeff Burns, Jordana Champagne, and Nick Ruskin.